I'm Dr. Mark Thornton at the Mises Institute, and this is lecture two of the class Bubbles, Booms, and Busts. And today what we're going to be looking at is the theoretical foundation of the Austrian theory of the business cycle, and also what the mainstream of economics views as their foundation in their theory of business cycles, booms, and busts. Last week, we finished up by looking at Irish economist Richard Cantillon and his contributions, or at least a few of them. If you go on to Mises.org and look up the Quarterly Journal of Austrian Economics, the first reading was from there, but I also have an article showing how Cantillon came up with the invisible hand view of the economy, and of course the one on the business cycle. And another paper that we're going to be looking at later in the course called the Skyscraper Index. It's called Skyscrapers and Business Cycles, inspired by Cantillon's work. So he came up with this idea that money is not neutral, and we're going to show that that debate continues today, that injections of money into the economy can have various effects, generally known as Cantillon effects. He was one of the first economists to point out that more money in an economy is not a good thing. And that's a lesson that economists learn, but have since forgotten. And so he is responsible for developing an early and very wide-ranging view of business cycles. He's the one that discovered the price-specie flow mechanism, where on the international gold standard, it provides a mechanism that equilibrates gold and prices throughout the world economy. And Rothbard shows that David Hume, the Scottish economist philosopher, and David Ricardo, the English economist, they borrowed from Cantillon some of his elements of the business cycle in order to create their view of the business cycle, which was later perfected by Mises and Hayek in the 20th century. Cantillon really gives us a big clue as to what is involved in the business cycle, and we're going to take it from there. Now, in terms of theory, first of all, we're going to look at sort of the theory of theory. What is the general background of economists? I think that's pretty important because I'm sure a lot of you wonder why in the world Paul Krugman thinks the way he does, or why Ben Bernanke thinks the way he does and conducts research in a certain way and comes to certain policy conclusions. Well, you have to get down deep in order to figure out exactly why. In mainstream economic thought, and of course that includes monetarists, Keynesians of all various colors and stripes, you'll find that prediction to them is the goal of economics, and that doesn't seem all that wild or crazy. I mean, when somebody goes to an economics lecture or goes to an economics class, that's precisely what they're looking for, is someone to tell them, is now a good time to invest? What do you think is going to happen to interest rates? And so as economists, Austrian and mainstream, we're constantly asked to make predictions about the future. But mainstream economics states that prediction is the very goal of economics, not understanding the world we live in, just making correct predictions. And to that end, it's perfectly okay to make unrealistic assumptions in the process of modeling the economy and the phenomenon you're looking at. You can make unrealistic assumptions about human behavior and the economy. For example, it's very common amongst mainstream economists all the way up to the Chicago School to view human behavior as constant over time. Your tastes and your preferences remain the same over time, and they never develop, they never change. And so that's an unrealistic assumption, but it's justified in order to make predictions. In other cases, such as with monetarism, it's perfectly okay in monetarism to model the economy, the overall macroeconomy, without a financial sector. and you know, things like that. So again, they can use unrealistic assumptions. They measure success on the basis of correct predictions. So everything from getting good statistics in your research or academic journal articles, all the way up to making forecasts of the economy at the President's Council of Economic Advisors, success is measured by their correct predictions, whether or not intervening events cause drastic changes within your model or within your macro forecast. Also, progress is achieved by better predictability, and of course, that seems justified that progress would be better be achieved by better predictability. But that also has a danger to it as well, because in a lot of cases, mainstream economists' ability to predict better over time has given them excess confidence in their forecast precisely at the time when they needed to be more and more cautious. And we're going to see that in various episodes in the past, how they become overly confident just before they were going to fall through the trap door. And their whole approach is to mimic the natural sciences, such as physics. Economists have physics envy and math envy and stat envy. They want to be like the natural sciences, where astronomers, for example, can correctly predict when and where and how fast a comet or an asteroid or a planet. They can write out mathematical formulas so as to project a spacecraft through the solar system and make it land precisely on the right side of a planet, you know, at a precise date out in the future. Physics can do that kind of thing. And so mainstream economists have envy for that kind of predictability. And so their approach is based on the natural sciences. And they also have the trend doctrine. And the trend doctrine, according to Mises, is that we know the past, we know the present, and if there's nothing drastically wrong, then basically mainstream economists call for the continuance of current policy and make basically trend predictions that if the economy has been growing at 3% on average over the last 10 years, then it will continue to grow at that same trend rate of 3% into the future without really knowing the underlying fundamentals. And then finally, the Econometric Society even has a motto where they state that science is prediction. So as you can see, the mainstream economists put a great deal of emphasis, practically their entire emphasis, on the idea of predicting the future and forecasting correctly the economy. Now, from the Austrian perspective, the mainstream is just wrong about a lot of their views. Austrian economics rejects forecasting as a scientific endeavor, in the sense that yes, you can make forecasts, you can make predictions, you can make educated guesses, but they're not necessarily going to come true, even if things stay relatively stable in the economy. So forecasting in the same way that they can do in the natural sciences with respect to asteroids and so forth isn't possible in the realm of human action. We reject forecasting in favor of qualitative predictions, where we give general pronouncements about the effect of certain policy changes and changes in the economy regarding the direction of change in certain variables that are related to the cause. We don't make predictions about the magnitude of the effect, the timing of the effect. Second, there's no constant relations in human action. Mises says that men are not like rocks. again, like in the natural sciences, who can conduct experiments that can be replicated an infinite number of times and getting the same result. Human behavior is just not like that. We're free to change our minds, we're free to develop our tastes in certain directions, and we're also free to act differently, make different choices in what otherwise would appear to be the same type of economic circumstances. So whereas the mainstream economists would measure various factors, and if you were placed in the same set of factors over and over again, you would continue to make that same choice. And you might make that same choice a number of times, but you have to remember that human action, we have free will, we can change our minds, and we can make different choices under what appears to be a similar set of circumstances. Okay, statistics, which is the bedrock of mainstream economics, statistics on human action should be considered history, not theory, or not some kind of economic law that can be used to project into the future. And quantifying human action is a hazardous endeavor. And human action, in terms of quantifying it, cannot be projected scientifically into the future. And so numbers concerning human action have to be taken with a grain of salt. For example, if I were to tell you that on a typical day I'll make about 5 tweets on Twitter, but today I made 10 tweets on Twitter, and that somehow confers the idea that I've been more productive, I've increased my productivity, production in terms of tweets is up, but the number 5 and 10 don't really have any kind of meaning with respect to human action. Those 5 a day could have been very well thought out, well-constructed, interesting tweets, and the 10 I did today might have been just empty tweets or silly tweets like everybody else. So the numbers can be misleading. A salesman could walk into the home base and say, I doubled my sales this week. And you would first think, well, that's great. This person deserves some kind of bonus or some kind of reward. But what if it was the case that he doubled his sales by giving misleading information about the products to your customers, or he provided fraudulent information about the product to your customers, or he cut the price by 50% to your customers and you end up taking the loss? So again, quantifying human action is hazardous and dangerous and can't be really used with much scientific validity. And finally, forecasting is seen by the Austrians as a self-contradiction. In other words, if you're trying to forecast human action, there's a logical self-contradiction in that position, because forecasting of human action isn't truly scientific. Mises thought this, von Morgenstern thought this, and Morgenstern, I think, was the second director of the Austrian Business Cycle Institute. Hayek thought that forecasting, for all intents and purposes, was impossible and a logical self-contradiction, but he held out the hope that certain type of prediction could be made valid. And to take a look at this self-contradiction, go to the next slide. Okay, for a forecast to be scientifically valid, it would have to be something correct and always correct, and something like 1 + 1 = 2. It can't be something like, I think the interest rate on 10-year government bonds is going to rise from 3% to 4%. That's not possible to make that a scientifically valid forecast or prediction. But let's just say that my forecasts are always correct, and everybody accepts my forecast is scientifically valid and always going to be correct. I've come from a different world and I can see into people's minds and I can take in all the information off of the internet through a computer and make scientifically valid forecasts. And one of my forecasts was for a boom to last in the economy, where the economy output, the economic output is increasing at a high rate for 6 months. The stock market goes up for 6 months, and then that's followed by a crash. Okay? What would people do? Well, people would tend to buy stocks, hold them for 6 months, and then sell them before the crash. Okay, my scientific forecasts are valid. Scientifically, I make that particular forecast. People who buy my services would therefore buy stocks today and sell them before the crash. But what would you do? In other words, it might change your activity. If you knew there was a crash coming, you probably want to sell slightly before the crash was coming. And if everybody was buying my services, because I was always correct, then a lot of people would start selling and thinking that they need to front load their selling position in order to get out of the stock market before everybody else. But if that really did start happening, then the crash would occur before the end of the 6 months, thereby invalidating the idea that that this forecast can possibly be scientific. So, in covering it in a general sense, comparing the Austrians to the mainstream, the Austrians take a theoretical view of economic and human behavior. The theory developed to help us understand economic behavior and to interpret economic history, so that the theory is based on cause and effect, things like the law of demand provide us with understanding and tools to interpret the world we live in and economic history. So we're always looking for cause and effect. And cause and effect is something that's not drawn up for you. It's something that has to be understood. It's a mental exercise in terms of logic, deduction, and then you're applying it to observation in order to make an interpretation to develop an understanding. And so in that process, again, man is not a rock. However, we do have the potential for praxeological prediction with apodictic certainty. That means that it's going to happen. It's can't be invalidated. If I was to say that the demand for a particular product called widgets was going to fall off dramatically, decrease dramatically, and all other things were held equal, ceteris paribus, which was a phrase that was given to us by Richard Cantillon, so that if all other things are held equal, then we can expect some kind of decrease in the price of widgets. And we can know that with apodictic certainty. And then Austrians also talk about pattern prediction. This is something that Hayek created, the idea that we can we're able to predict patterns in the economy, much like those simpler praxeological predictions based on ceteris paribus. However, as I mentioned in the first lecture, we can say nothing about the timing of events or the magnitude of events. I was just on a radio program called Butler on Business, headed out of Atlanta, and it's also on the internet, but we went through this whole discussion of the Austrian theory of the business cycle and the Fed and how bad things have become from our point of view. And at the very end, he asked me, well, when do you think all this is going to happen? And I said, well, you know, we don't have any tools to make, to give you a date or a magnitude. And, you know, there's a lot of variables that are going to change between now and whenever the next crisis occurs in the economy. So we just don't have those tools. And I even admitted that, you know, if things happened when I thought that they happened, that things would have already happened, basically. So in contrast to that, the mainstream is very empirical. They're a data-driven branch of economics. Their whole goal, their whole purpose, their whole measuring stick for their success is based on the ability to make correct predictions. Obviously, this is statistically based, where they take history, numerical history about human action, and they try to develop relationships between factors and variables and outcomes, and then project those into the future. They make unrealistic assumptions, such as Homo economicus, where you have economic man who's, you know, rational, perfectly rational, profitably motivated, and never changing. So they're interested in statistical significance of things. History has shown that that's a, it kind of works in the short run, but it doesn't work in the long run. And they're very much, in terms of macroeconomics, the overall economy, they deal in aggregates. And you're going to see one of the weaknesses of the mainstream is that they deal in these large aggregates like gross domestic product, where Austrians want to constantly break down the economy into components to see what's going on with the components of the economy. So, for example, mainstream economists would look at GDP, aggregate spending, things of that nature, whereas Austrians would like to break it down into consumer goods and capital goods, investment goods, you know, breaking it down to smaller components to study. Okay. Now, things are not so cut and dry as I may have made them look. There's a lot of contradictions, I think, within mainstream economics as well as within Austrian economics, at least a little bit. You'll very often see mainstream economists reject their methods in practice. So that Walter Block tells a tale where he was a graduate assistant doing his dissertation under Gary Becker at Columbia University. He won a Nobel Prize, and Walter Block came in with some statistical results which showed that rent control increased the number of apartments and and things of that nature. And Gary Becker just dismissed him and said, Block, get out of here and go get it right. Redo your empirical work, in other words, until you get it right. Well, the theory of the theory of mainstream economics says you just accept the data as it is. You don't have any hard and fast theory that can't be undermined by future empirical evidence. And so at heart, they will cling to, especially in microeconomics, more of an Austrian notion, although that's certainly not the case with macroeconomics. And of course, Austrians very often do empirical research, historical research, using theory to illustrate and to understand history. Maybe more funny, and this is something we'll take a look at, is that the mainstream actually has a lousy record of predicting the economy. And they often, they'll have a good short-term record, and they'll get cocky and make very lousy predictions. And in contrast to that, we're going to see that the Austrian have a pretty good record in terms of predicting some of the major economic crisis, the major bubbles, booms and busts over the last 100 years. Okay, now for that I came across this interview this week of David Laidler. And I'm going to play a clip of it. Laidler was one of the foremost monetary economists, a monetarist, someone who believed that you increase the supply of money and you keep that increase in the supply of money in lockstep with increases in spending in the economy, and you'll have stability. And so he laid the groundwork in the 60s and 70s for what is monetarism. So he was one of the leading authorities, along with, of course, Milton Friedman. And Laidler is now retired, and he did this interview with Russ Roberts. And I highly recommend the entire interview, but I'm just going to play a couple of rather startling clips here where Laidler admits that monetarism failed, and even notes that the Austrians were right. And so 14 minutes into the interview, they've been discussing this failure of monetarism to provide an understanding for the economy of the 1990s and the 2000s.
Eventually, when the economy comes around. I don't think that's a problem for next year. You know, I think we've got a way to go yet.
It's a rare moment of honesty from even an econ podcast. I appreciate that. I want to go to a question.
A rare moment of honesty. I got a kick out of that one.
That I've asked many times to different guests.
And, this is Russ Roberts.
I appreciate my listeners' patience, but I think you actually have a lot of insight into this question relative to some of the people I asked, and that's the following. I was trained, as you were, at the University of Chicago, and I was taught that when you think about monetary policy, you think about quantity. You think about the quantity of money. Now, you might debate or be unsure, as you just alluded to, as to which definition, which aggregate measure is the right one. But we were told to look at quantities. You want to understand the impact on the nominal economy. You want to look at the impact of monetary policy on inflation. You look at money, the quantity of money. And yet, over the last 10, 15, 20 years, the chairs of the Fed, plus many monetary economists, always talk about interest rates. What's going on there? Why is there two different approaches? And help me understand that.
Well, what I think happened was that people like me in the 70s and 80s overstated the case for the reliability of the rate of growth of the money supply as the anchor for monetary policy. Things didn't work out as well as expected in a number of places. You also had, you know, Milton Friedman's really catastrophically bad call at the end of the book, disinflation, the double-digit inflation that just around the corner again. And central banks were put off relying on money growth. And I think they threw the baby out with the bathwater. I think money growth targeting was a very effective policy framework. But I don't think that was a good reason to stop looking at these variables altogether, but a lot of people did. And parallel to that, of course, you had developments in monetary theory starting in the 1980s, 1990s, big names there, people like John Taylor and Michael Woodford, Lars Fenton, who started building models of monetary policy in which they simply cut out the financial system altogether and just concentrated on direct links between policy interest rates and the level of spending in the economy. And that kind of model works just fine when the monetary system is functioning. When the monetary system is functioning, you could ignore it. And I'm afraid we had about 15 years when leading scholars of monetary economics just took the monetary and financial system out of their analysis. And that's been a shame. I hope that one beneficial side effect of the last few dreadful years is people will stop paying attention to those monetary aggregates again. Just as a side remark, in Europe, you know, the European Central Bank had a ref.
I think that's really remarkable how he basically throws monetarism under the bus, basically, that it wasn't working, that they were making catastrophic predictions. They had, for some reason or another, eliminated the financial markets from their models of the economy, and it led to disastrous results.
So the with a rate of growth of AMS 3 as a sort of backup to its regular policy-making framework. And for reasons that are quite beyond me, this reference value has disappeared altogether in the last 3 or 4 years. Money growth has been incredibly sluggish in the EU. And look at the stagnation in that economy. I don't think that's an accident.
Is there a parallel in the U.S. economy? I remember after I interviewed Milton in 2006, I questioned him about one of his claims about the Great Moderation, which we, of course, were at the tail end of at the time. We didn't realize it. But yeah, it was one of the thrills of my life that a 90-plus-year-old economist, I think Milton was 92 at that point, sent me a spreadsheet. And he said, oh, you don't want to look at M1, you want to look at M2. And M2 was pretty was very, very steady, as he had essentially claimed. But it hasn't really has M2 reflected this crisis that we're in?
My recollection is that it did indeed. That its growth rate really went into a bit of a spin in 2000 after the collapse of Lehman Brothers. But in the last little while, let's go back again. Yeah, I've just got this up on my computer screen just to check. And M2 at the end of 2008 was actually growing for a little while, close to 10% of the peak. And then it went into a spin and almost go down, its growth rate almost go down to zero by early 2010. And then the growth rate's been coming back since. So what you don't find in the U.S. monetary aggregate data is any sign that there was going to be a major downturn starting in 2008. There's no big contraction in money growth before the downturn started. Now that's one of the mysteries about this particular episode. But once it got the
In other words, what he's saying was that the whole monetarist model about looking at the money supply and aggregate economic activity didn't work for this economic crisis, that the money supply continued to grow at a double-digit pace until long after the crisis had actually transpired here in the U.S.
You've got this spiraling downwards. As I say, this time around, unlike the 1930s, the Fed's expansionary reaction to that put a stop to the contraction before it gathered too much momentum.
Yeah, well, obviously there's a cause and effect issue in monetary policy, especially when it comes to a financial crisis. And if you
Right. I mean, the process is a recursive one, right? Monetary tightening causes the economy to contract, but a contracting economy, if you don't watch it, starts making the money supply contract even further. Well, and that's what was going on.
And I would say, especially if it originates in the financial sector, and there's some debate about, you allude to it in some of your recent writing, about what I would call the real side or the microeconomic side. And you point out that the Austrian view, the idea that both the 29 collapse and the current mess did see a very rapid run up in asset prices that suddenly collapsed, and that obviously caused some challenges for the financial sector.
Yeah, I mean, that's right. I mean, people keep calling these things financial crises. They're really asset market crises, and they happen on the margin between, markets for financial assets and markets for real assets, like real estate and factories and physical investment. I don't think the monetarist story of the onset of the Great Depression, by the way, or the monetarist story of the onset of this Great Recession is quite plausible enough. I can't find anything in the data in the 1920s. All the data in the run-up to this event that shows a degree of sort of conventional tightening of money growth that can account for the speed of the subsequent downturn. That really looks like, in both cases, an economy where something was going badly wrong in real asset markets, and it just needed a little bit of tap from the financial markets to set a downward spiral going. And you're right, and in the Austrians were the pioneers of this kind of analysis in the 20s even. And of course, there are still Austrians around, and if I may sort of put in a plug.
Well, there you have it. The monetarists got it wrong, and the Austrians got it right, and that's something that I haven't heard from a monetarist, especially such a high-ranking one as Professor David Laidler. He's a very big in that circle, and it makes me wonder why we're getting this concession here from a prominent monetarist, that the monetarists got it wrong consistently, whether you look at the 1920s, the current crisis, Friedman's horrible predictions with regard to both inflation and the current crisis. And so only later in the interview do you hear the reason for this concession by Professor Laidler. Let's see.
Having been said, I still think you've got to look at something more deep going on in asset markets to explain the severity of the downturn.
So you think it's much more than just a monetary phenomenon?
Yeah, I do. I mean, I never thought I would live to say this, but on this particular instance, I'm inclined to line up with the Austrians. I think they really have a point about this issue, about asset market distortion after long periods of monetary stability.
Well, this again puts you in a small group of economists who've learned something from the crisis. I find it remarkable how many people have managed to keep their theological views unchanged by this experience.
Well, you must remember that I'm retired, so I don't have to worry about being a journalist anymore.
Well, there you have it. He recants his monetarism. He says that the Austrians were right. And basically the only reason he was able to come forth with this recantation was that he's retired. He doesn't have to face the wrath of Economic Journal editors. So I just thought that was just an incredible interview, and I encourage you all to take a look at that. I see someone put up a link in the chat to be able to pick up that. Okay, so what are business cycles? I'm going to start with this. From two mainstream economists, two prominent mainstream economists, Arthur Burns and Wesley Mitchell. I'll read this to you because I know it's small. And their standard definition of the business cycle, quote, "Business cycles are a type of fluctuation found in the aggregate economic activity of nations that organize their work mainly in business enterprises. A cycle consists of expansions occurring at about the same time in many economic activities, followed by similar general recessions, contractions, and revivals, which merge into the expansion phase of the next cycle. In durations, business cycles vary from more than 1 year to 10 or 12 years. They are not divisible into shorter cycles with similar characteristics with amplitudes approximating their own." And then Burns goes on to write, "Business cycles are not merely fluctuations in aggregate economic activity. The critical feature that distinguishes them from the commercial convulsions of earlier centuries or from the seasonal and other short-term variations of our own age is that the fluctuations are widely diffused over the economy, its industry, its commercial dealings, its tangles of finance. The economy of the Western world is a system of closely interrelated parts. He who would understand business cycles must master the workings of an economic system organized largely in a network of free enterprises searching for profit. The problem of how business cycles come about is therefore inseparable from the problems of how a capitalist economy functions." And I think this is worth taking a look at, because you notice that they talk about aggregate economic activities and how these expansions and contractions are general across the economy in all of its various sectors. And I think the last part here, "he who would understand business cycles must master the working of an economic system organized on free enterprise for profit. The problem of business cycles therefore inseparable from the problem of how a capitalist economy functions." But that's not something that they do. They don't actually look at how a capitalist economy functions. They, the mainstream has microeconomics and macroeconomics. And in macroeconomics, they look at the economy in aggregates rather than in all of its various component parts. And this is where I think the Austrians get a big leg up because they do look at different components of the economy and how they're actually interrelated and why they function correctly and what makes them misfunction. Okay. Austrian business cycle. Okay. With the Austrian business cycle theory, we begin with a situation of a free market economy in mind. And in a free market economy, as Rothbard points out, there's no expectations of general booms and busts. There's no general expectation that the overall economy would suffer from underconsumption or overproduction or any of those kind of things. In a free market economy, we would expect prices to adjust and for markets to clear, and so there's not going to be any aggregate problems of contraction and expansion. We also begin with the idea that there is a structure of production in an economy of these interrelated industries and firms where capital is distributed across the economy in such a way that there are firms that, for example, go out and obtain raw materials and other firms that turn those raw materials into usable inputs into the various production processes. So you might be talking about steel going into a variety of different capital goods such as tractors, automobiles, and so forth. And so that there's this structure of production out there for everything from raw materials to consumer goods. So we start with raw materials and eventually passes through various stages of production until you finally get to the consumer good. So in a very simple way, we could look at the first order good in the economy being bread that's consumed by consumers, and that's made on the basis of wheat, water, and other heat ovens and so forth. That the wheat comes from a flour mill where grain is ground into flour. And then you go to higher order goods such as plows to work the wheat fields, combines to harvest, fertilizer companies to provide fertilizer, and higher order goods such as chemicals that can be used to fight insects and weeds and things of that nature. So when we look at the economy, we look at a structure of production that goes from everywhere from the first order goods or consumer goods to higher order goods that are used to produce those goods. And all of the capital in all these various stages of production has to be sustained over a long period of time until the product finally gets to the consumer who ultimately buys and consumes the bread. And so, yes, the economy is a very, very complex phenomenon, and it's impossible for even Austrians to give you a complete and full picture of the complexity of the overall structure of production, but at least we realize that there is this structure of production. What is the structure of production? Well, it's the world we live in. Everywhere around you, homes, apartments, computers, trucks, cars, that whole structure of production out there of factories and warehouses, transportation systems. The structure of production is the world we live in, and in particular, that part of the world where goods are produced for consumers. This structure of production is financed or sustained by accumulated savings. So the world as we know it is the result of the accumulation of savings over hundreds and hundreds of years, basically, that we've been able to accumulate and sustain and maintain all of the capital out there in the economy. Of course, some capital is completely depreciated. Other capital is found to be no longer have value, and so it's necessarily set aside. But the remaining capital that makes up the structure of production is maintained or sustained by accumulated savings. And that is all property on the basis of ownership, which is denoted by the ownership of stocks and bonds, checking account numbers, savings account numbers, titles and deeds, etc., to show who's in control of all of that capital in the structure of production. And so the Austrians note that for production in the economy to increase, the structure of production has to have additional capital and additional savings in order to grow, basically. And so the phenomenon of economic growth, in order to differentiate real economic growth from a bubble or a boom in the economy, what we look for is that lower time preferences on the part of the population. If the time preferences are reduced, if we're not concerned about consuming everything we get our hands on immediately, and we're willing to put off consumption into the future, that means that we save part of our income, and we don't consume 100% of our income today, but we increase our savings and we decrease current consumption. When that happens throughout the overall economy, it results in lower interest rates in the economy. If there's more savings, given any demand for loanable funds, you're going to see a reduction in time preferences resulting in a reduction in interest rates. And when interest rates fall, of course, everybody knows, ceteris paribus, that investment is going to increase in the economy. And then that's going to be make available an increase in, at least an anticipated increase in future consumption. Okay, lengthening the structure of production. This is what the Austrian theory is all about, is that it's not just more investment, but it's a change in the pattern of investment in the economy. What we talked about earlier in terms of the structure of production and what it looked like and how industries were connected from one to the other, well, a lower interest rate will tend to lengthen this structure of production so that there's more steps and more time involved in getting from, say, something like raw materials to getting to the consumer goods. The lower interest rate changes the payoff for capital investment. Lower interest rates, obviously, is a reduction in the cost of borrowing, and this increases the payoff to potential capital investments in the economy. It increases the payoff specifically for longer structured or more roundabout production processes. So that, typically we don't like to take more roundabout processes. We'd rather have a direct process. If you want to get from anywhere from point A to point B, you want to go in a straight line. However, there are circumstances where a more roundabout process might make sense. So instead of me going directly from the Mises Institute to my house in what is the straightest possible direction, it might make sense for me to take a side route to get on an interstate and then using that interstate and driving faster, get to my ultimate destination more efficiently. Okay, this price, this change in the interest rate, effectively will change what is produced in an economy and how it is produced in an economy. In other words, you can think of it as a change in the technology of production. We're going to be doing different things and producing different products. My example of this is milk production and how milk production differs today from when I was a kid growing up. And this is an example of a natural change in the economy where production became more roundabout and became more efficient. I grew up in Geneva, New York. As a kid that knew what I was doing to a certain degree, say around 1970. Geneva was a city of a population of about 20,000 people, and it was probably about a city with a diameter of about 2 to 2.5 miles. And on the edge of the city, so if you've got a piece of paper, just draw a circle on the piece of paper to denote the city of Geneva, and then on the edge of that circle, put in three D's for the three dairies that existed at the edge of the city, equal distance from one another. And then finally, there were 12 dairy farms outside the city. And so for that, I'd like you to draw outside of the circle, because there's no dairy farms inside the city, place 12 rectangular boxes around that circle. And basically what happened in my childhood was that the dairy farmers would go out early in the morning and milk their cows. They'd put that milk on a truck and drive it to one of the three dairies at the edge of the city. The dairies would then take that milk, pay for it, and then they would put it into cartons and refrigerate it. The next morning, they would take that milk in those cartons, and these little trucks would drive off in all directions with men dressed in white uniforms with a white hat around 4 o'clock in the morning, and they would come to your house, go to the back door, and put the milk in a little milk box by your back door. And so when you woke up in the morning, there was fresh milk, fresh cold milk right outside your back door. Now, that's a pretty short structure of production. That's a pretty direct structure of production. If you draw arrows from the 12 dairy farms to the closest dairy or D at the edge of the city, and then draw arrows from the dairy to, say, pick a place inside the circle and label it H, and then draw a line from that dairy farm directly to your house, you see that that's a very short structure of production, basically a 24-hour structure of production, involving very little capital, but quite a bit of labor. I mean, you've got all the farmers and all the milkers and all the people delivering milk to the various houses in the morning. Okay. Now for the more modern, more roundabout method of milk production. And again, on a piece of paper, you could sort of draw out this example for yourself, or you do the same circle for the city of Geneva. There's no dairies there anymore, and there hasn't been for a long time. There's no longer 12 dairy farms. There's 8 much larger dairy farms in the vicinity of Geneva. And there's a regional dairy about 20 miles away. So instead of the milk going directly from the farm to the dairy to your house, now a very large truck comes out from the regional dairy and goes to all 8 of those dairies and collects milk from all 8 of those dairies and brings it 20 miles back to the regional dairy, where it's homogenized, pasteurized, produced, and cartoned and refrigerated. And then another truck, a different truck, goes out and brings the milk products to the grocery store, where you have to go pick them up. So this is a much more roundabout structure of production. It involves much more capital at the regional dairy. There's more technology, conveyor belts, and all sorts of things. The truck that carries the milk is not a pickup truck, but it's a big 18-wheeler. So there's more division of labor, and there's less labor overall. There's less labor used in this production structure than in the previous one. And hence, milk is actually lower cost, lower price product as a result of this more roundabout, more capital intensive structure of production and milk production. Okay, so that's the normal means of economic growth where savings is used to lengthen the structure of production, and there's no negative about that. People have increased their savings, and entrepreneurs have lengthened the structure of production and driven down the cost of milk. Things are not the same way in the economic boom. An economic boom, it's bank credit expansion beyond normal deposits that create boom conditions. This occurs primarily under central banking. Theoretically, it can exist in a free banking system, especially if there's some privileges for banks or some implicit bailout provisions or backup provisions. But generally speaking, bank credit expansions under central banking is the real problem here. The bank credit expansion results in an increased supply of credit and a decrease in the interest rate in the economy. This leads to an increase in investment and an increase in consumption as well. So by the central bank expanding the supply of credit, banks are then able to make more loans, and given a demand for loanable funds, the lower interest rate is going to result in an increase in investment, and the lower interest rate is also going to decrease savings and increase consumption in the economy. So all the conditions are right with increases in investment and increases in consumption for a boom. And so that's the prerequisites, essentially, for a boom in the economy where you see, according to the mainstream economic view, an increase in aggregate spending in the economy. However, that increase in the aggregate spending, when you break it down, you realize that it particularly occurs in higher order goods in the economy. So the Austrian story, I think, is backed up by the fact that you see the errors in the economy, the profits and the losses occurring in particular industries. And noteworthy here are technological industries. There's always a certain set of technologies that we're using, and there's always a set of technology that, as Rothbard said, is sitting on the shelf ready to be used under the right conditions. Then there's the construction industry. Most booms result in some kind of increase in the production of construction, of real estate, of structures, and so forth, and also durable equipment that's supposed to last a long period of time. When you see that interest rate come down, you see the demand for durable equipment increase, as well as new types of technology and the construction of new facilities. This appears to be, at this point in time, a cluster of entrepreneurial successes. Everybody's making money. Everybody's making more money than they expected to, and everybody's growing increasingly cocky with respect to their business ventures. They're becoming more speculative. They're willing to take more chances on things during the boom, when everything seems great. But the boom is the problem, according to the Austrians. We view the boom as where it's not entrepreneurial successes, but it's really entrepreneurs making errors in their investments. Okay, the boom is followed inevitably by the bust. The problem is we don't know how long the expansion of credit at the central bank is going to take place. We don't know to what extent banks are going to take advantage of that, how much credit they're going to issue, and in what areas are these investments necessarily going to take place. But we do know that inevitably there's going to be a bust in the economy. First of all, investors have to compete with each other for land and labor. So more investments, more investors starting more and more projects, so they have to, they're competing with one another for land, labor, and as a result, they drive up prices of their inputs, or they have higher costs than expected. Higher wages, as a result, are directed at consumer goods, not capital goods, and so you get price inflation, and you tend to get a bigger price premium put into interest rates. And then, in addition to that, as all of these investments come online, the products produced in this new structure of production face tougher than expected competition. And so this has happened in various points in time with various boom-bust cycles where people are putting all their money into internet companies or computer companies or real estate, and they're driving up each other's costs. But as these products start to come onto market, the market eventually reveals the fact that there were too many computer chip facilities made at a particular time, or there were too many internet browser companies that came online simultaneously. And so the problem here is higher cost and lower prices, lower profits that, of course, in some areas manifest themselves in terms of losses and bankruptcies, restructuring, all sorts of readjustments that have to take place because expectations were not met. The great enthusiasm during the boom turns to economic depression, mal investments that have taken place in trying to restructure the structure of production have to be liquidated through bankruptcy and restructuring other means. And, of course, the labor attached to all those bad investments is also, in a sense, liquidated or becomes unemployed. And the cluster of entrepreneurial errors is revealed to us. Okay, so that is the basic Austrian view on booms and busts. We started with the theory of theories in terms of where Austrians and mainstream economists are coming from, and then put out the Austrian theory of the business cycle. Some of the things in particular that it looks at and why it's different, why we're looking at that structure of production, why we're looking at the cause and effect and the interconnectedness throughout the economy. And also underlying that aggregate, we look for particular areas where we would see both the boom and the bust take place, and I mentioned a couple examples of that were technological changes, technology industries, capital goods industries, and construction. Okay, let's see if we can find some questions here. Okay, question. Would it be fair to say that asset price inflation is more or less inflation in higher order capital goods such as real estate, stocks, and bonds? It's a very good question. It's something we would definitely want to address, and it fits in extremely well with this whole notion of how Austrians and mainstream economists are different from one another. Basically, if you look today at mainstream economists, they're fixated on the consumer price index. That's probably the worst area of price inflation that you should be looking at if you're concerned with business cycle issues and trying to get a feel for where we are in the business cycle. The same thing happened to Irving Fisher in the 1920s. He was looking at the wholesale price index as a measuring tool to see if monetary policy was maintaining a relatively fixed value of the dollar. And the modern mainstream economists are likewise fixated on the value of the dollar. They're inflation targeters. They want to see inflation between 0 and 2%. They want to, you know, keep the value of the dollar within those parameters. And that's really the wrong place to be looking at prices. If you're concerned about the business cycle, you want to look at the price of higher order goods, which is has the most effect from interest rate deviating from the natural rate. So there's a natural rate of interest in the economy based on market forces and time preferences. And then there's the altered rate that is given by the central bank. So that's, of course, a primary price that we look at, but we also look at asset price inflation, the stock market in particular, because stock prices are greatly impacted by alterations of the interest rate. And then real estate prices, of course, and higher good prices are precisely the place where you should be looking for, looking at prices. Consumer prices really don't tell you much of anything. As I said in the structure of production part of the lecture, the consumer area is relatively stable over the boom-bust cycle. It's the other areas of the structure of production that are much more variable and much more volatile when interest rates are not determined by the market. Okay, question. I think everything boils down to the question, how much money do we need for a good functioning of economy? It is very strange for me that the economists did not reach a conclusion on this basic problem. Well, it's a good question. The general Austrian view is that, and I think this has been a general economic view for a long period of time until recently, which was that any supply of money would actually do. If prices are allowed to adjust, you could have virtually any supply beyond some kind of physical necessity, and that would solve the problem, and you don't need to increase the supply of money over time. Mainstreamers not only view it that you need to increase the supply of money over time, but they think that that's actually what generates economic growth. So I think they're very wrong about all that. And I think that the Austrians, from Cantillon on down, have said that basically any supply of money will do for an economy, that prices will adjust, and that actually new gold mining is brought about by the sort of the physical necessity of having enough physical gold to go around and silver to go around. But that anything beyond that is negative on the economy, because new gold mining, say there was a big, huge discovery of gold mining and a bunch of people went into gold mining, and all that labor was taken out of the market. And so you had less production in the economy. You just had more money with the assumption that, you know, gold doesn't go into goods that we view as consumer goods. But if it just went into monetary purposes, we'd be needing fewer goods. And if you weren't a gold miner, your net income, your purchasing power would actually be reduced, so it would be a problem. So generally speaking, Austrians just want the market to determine what money is and how much money is in an economy. But for all practical purposes, any supply of money will do. It doesn't have to grow. Why are higher wages directed at consumer goods? It would seem that there is a higher demand for labor in the capital goods sector as well. What I'm referring there to is the higher wages of your labor are going to be spent by that labor in terms of consumer goods. Remember that the time preferences have not been reduced by central bank policy. Consumers want to consume more consumer goods, and higher wages is precisely the way in which they can accomplish that. Question: if mainstream's methodology is incorrect, their theories, should also tend to be incorrect. And then their predictions should tend to be incorrect. How can they measure their success by correct predictions when they tend to be wrong all the time? Well, they're actually not wrong all the time. In long periods where the economy is stable, when it's on trend, when the Fed is not making huge mistakes in terms of matching up their policy interest rates with market determined rates, the economy stays close to trend. And so for very long periods of time, they can be correct, or at least some of them can be correct. But a lot of that is just the fact, not that their methodology is useful or that their theories are useful. It's just that the economy is stable and growing at a anticipated level. And so they can make correct predictions, but it seems every time when it really counts, when there's really a change in the business cycle, they very much fail to make the correct prediction. As a matter of fact, if they go through a long period where the economy is growing or when it's in boom conditions and they're adjusting their forecast to higher and higher rates of economic growth, they become exuberant, and they maintain their ever-growing increases in their expectations or in their predictions. And so just as we get to a point when the economy is going to turn down, their models are usually telling us that the economy is going to grow great, prosperity is assured into the future, the stock market's going over higher, and so that's where the problem occurs. Okay, who would be your top 3 to 5 economists in history? Where would you rank? Cantillon would rank for you. Well, I would say Cantillon is the best economist in economic in history, primarily because there really wasn't much economic theory prior to Cantillon, and so he was the inventor of so much of what we know is economics. And it was really in developing a method and a theory and applying it and coming up with so many different models and tools in the economy that makes Cantillon so valuable and made him so influential. I mean, that's where Adam Smith and David Hume and the French liberals and the Austrians got a lot of their economics from. And then I would rank Mises, for sure, second, because he's certainly done more to refine economic methodology, economic theory, to integrate micro and macro together to bridge that gap that economists couldn't bridge between the microeconomy and the money macroeconomy. He's responsible for that. He developed economic methodology to such a significant extent. And then I'd rank Rothbard third, for all of his contributions as an economist, historian, and philosopher. I think that his work was probably more influential in my life, in my career, than anyone else's. And hopefully, I have time to get to Murray Rothbard's America's Great Depression, because I think that's definitely one of the big things. And then F.A. Hayek, who's clearly a brilliant, multidimensional scholar that just made tremendous and high-level contributions to the social sciences. I believe that you said that Cantillon's essay was published anonymously and after his death, which may have been staged. Why was it published anonymously and after his death? Were any of his economic works or other published while he was alive? No, he was very secretive, and the French government censored publications, and Cantillon's work would have been viewed as anti-government and critical of the monarch's economic policies. In the current case and through history, he basically points the finger at government in many different times and places as the cause of economic problems of all sorts. So he couldn't have gotten it published. And he was a very secretive person. He was the wealthiest private individual in the world, or one of them, subject to a lot of lawsuits and criminal trials. And so it wasn't going to happen. They think that he staged his death in order to avoid all of these lawsuits and death threats. And so the books circulated in manuscript form, hand copies of the manuscript, until 1755, when the physiocrats got their hands on a copy and realized its importance and had it published under a defunct publisher anonymously and with some misleading information regarding the publication of the book itself. It was only later in the 18th century where the censorship rules were relaxed in France. In last week's reading, you mentioned on page 52, Cantillon's Trade Cycle. In which section of the essay does he address this issue? It's in the third section of the essay. The essay is broken down into three parts. The first part is about microeconomics, population, geography, property. And then he moves in progressively more complex situations, and the trade cycle and different types of boom-bust situations are developed in the third section. Question. Austrians often say that the Fed is lowering interest rates to artificially low levels. Everything that the Fed does is manipulation. So shouldn't the only Austrian position be that there should be no central bank instead of opining on Fed rates? Well, I think the general position that most Austrian economists come to is that there should not be a central bank, that money should be a market phenomenon, and that banking should be a non-privileged situation for banking and a market phenomenon. It would put a tight cap on the issuing of fiduciary media by banks. But from time to time, I mean, Austrians basically, we've spotted situations where central bank policy has resulted in a boom, which coincides with interest rates that appear to be artificially low. The distinction between market rates and actual rates set by the Federal Reserve is, we're sort of guessing at where the natural rate is versus the current rate. But if it's a low rate in conjunction with booming asset prices, that's a very good indication right there. Question. What observations would indicate a developing bust? Well, the factors that I went over earlier, where you see rising costs in boom industries, where you see intensifying competition in those same industries, those higher order goods industries, that's bringing on the difficult situations for those companies. And you're going to see that first in high-tech type industries, construction and finance. In 2006, I was keeping my eye on the Philadelphia Home Builder Stock Index because I been writing about the housing bubble for quite some time. I've been speaking about it, giving lectures and so forth. And so I was keeping my eye on the Philadelphia Home Builder Stock Index. And I don't remember what week it was. I think it was in July of 2006. There was a major correction in that index, you know, negative correction that looked significant to me. And so I alerted readers of LouRockwell.com, a website that many of you are no doubt familiar with. And I was writing, at that time I went to Lou in 2004 or 2005, I said, you know, I think I need to start writing some articles about the economy and stock markets and stuff. And so he gave me a regular column there for a while, and that's one of the things I was doing, is keeping an eye on those particular things. Question? I don't think we got that one. Question. If we assume that it's technologically possible to forbid all cash exchanges, leaving only electronic flow of money from account to account, and monitor these flows, do you think it would be possible to empirically prove the Cantillon effects in the ABC theory? Well, Austrians don't believe in empirically proving anything, basically. That isn't to say that people haven't made efforts to empirically back up the Austrian theory of the business cycle, or indeed Cantillon effects. But to the beginning of the question, if we assume that it is technologically possible to forbid all cash exchanges, leaving only electronic flows of money from account to account, I think that's something that the government is interested in doing. For example, in Sweden, they've really put a crunch on the use of cash in their economy. And so I think for various reasons, central banks and law enforcement agencies are trying to drive all exchanges away from cash and into electronic transactions to keep better tabs on it. I mean, they think they can monitor and regulate the economy. They have a terrible track record of doing that. And I don't think forbidding cash exchanges would improve their ability to somehow regulate markets in a macro sense. And again, we don't really believe in proving theories. We're looking at whether or not they're logical, whether they fit the sense of human action that we're basing everything on. Question. What is the take on mainstream economists on Austrian business cycles? As a non-expert, I find this explanation of the boom bust logical. Well, you know, you have to go back through the entire lecture on this, but basically mainstream economists have long ignored the Austrian theory of the business cycle. And to the extent that they bring it up, they usually misname it, characterize it, you know, for example, Paul Krugman refers to us as the hangover theory of the business cycle, and they refer to our fiscal policy views incorrectly as the Austerians, conflating, you know, incorrect concepts basically about the economy. So they ignored us, they disparaged us, but one of the reasons I wanted to bring that interview on of David Laidlaw was that if you take it as a whole, basically what he admit was that monetarism, his baby, what he's known for, was flawed, was deeply flawed, and that the Austrian approach was basically correct about the two most important economic crisis in U.S. history, and he admits it. But he only admitted it after he retired and didn't have to face the wrath of journal articles, because the journal editors of journals on monetary and macroeconomics, 85% of them, the editors and the editorial board, have either worked for the Fed or been a consultant for the Fed or are working for the Fed. And so the Fed's money in the market for macroeconomics is a big player. And I think ultimately that the views of monetary and macroeconomics are skewed as a result of that. Larry White has published an article on this in Econ Journal Watch. It's online, and you can find it. And it was really an eye-opener for me. I knew that to some extent it was going on, but not to the overwhelming extent that it actually had been. Question: what can one do to survive and benefit from the incoming busts? Not something I'm a big expert on. I'm not a financial analyst. I've always tried to pay attention to traditional investing techniques, which can help you survive severe swings in the business cycle. I'm a big believer in saving. I'm a big believer in owning gold. I'm a big believer in staying away from debt and to have multiple sources of income and to keep your expenditures below your income. And all of that makes it easier to survive a crash or a crunch. And even if there's nothing coming, you can just be more relaxed about things. You don't have to worry about losing your only job and not being able to make any payments and losing your house and your car and everything else. I have an article on LouRockwell.com called Traditional Investing, I think it's called. Question: in a free market economy, what would be the cause of booms and busts and bubbles? Is there an article on this that you can recommend? Some could be discovery, extraction of new gold, silver mines, changing currencies, adoption of new technologies and Fed. Yes, there are other causes for big swings in the economy, some of which you mentioned. Great new technological developments can cause a big upswing in the economy. Things like the weather, plagues, dramatic population changes, demography, a lot of those other things that can cause above trend economic growth or below trend economic growth. But Austrians distinguish between those other types of phenomenon in the aggregate economy and the business cycle itself. I'll try to think of something to recommend to read on that, but I don't have anything off the top of my head. Question: can the tendency towards higher demand and prices in a boom be offset by currency manipulation by major trading partners? Well, they certainly can be influenced by that. There's a lot of talk about how savings from Asia had an impact on the U.S. economy. And, when we lay out the general theory of the business cycle, we're looking at a large open economy where we're talking about a worldwide economy. And there's no national divisions typically, but if you do have national divisions, then you can see cross-border effects. And I think that we definitely saw that here. When we went into the housing bubble and labor was diverted from manufacturing in the U.S. to housing, we picked up manufacturing by importing more goods from China. As well as savings as well. Okay, question. Rothbard thought that Mises' theory of money and banking was the best book on the subject. Is it still the best book on theory of money and banking? What would be the top five books on the subject? Well, that's a very good question. I would certainly recommend Jesus Hernando de Soto's book, which is the most recent book on this subject and is very complete and comprehensive. And so that certainly would be one of them. Joseph Salerno's book, something like Good Money, Bad Money. It's a collection of essays that Joe has written over his career, and it's really an outstanding collection. My only recommendation would be to read the articles in the fifth section first and work your way towards the front in terms of the five sections of that book. I would recommend Murray Rothbard's the smallest thing is What Has Government Done to Our Money? And also The Mystery of Banking. And finally, Rothbard's America's Great Depression, because I think that sealed the deal with me in terms of Austrian economics. That when I read Friedman and then compared it to Rothbard, it was very clear to me that Rothbard had it right, and he made the whole experience of the America's Great Depression logically based for me, and so I really appreciated that. Okay, I guess we should call, let's see, now I've got a few minutes. Question, presumably, if the natural rate of interest is not observable, can there be times when the central bank sets the rate of interest at the natural rate of interest by accident? If so, boom bust could be avoided. Yes, I mean, as I said earlier, we don't know what the natural rate is. But, through mechanisms similar to those developed during socialist calculation debate, the Fed might be able to come close and try to stay close to the natural rate. And it could get the natural rate simply by not intervening in the federal funds market. If it just stayed out, then the interest rate in the federal funds market would go to the natural rate, and then all the other interest rates in the economy, money market mutual fund rates, loan rates, commercial paper rates, mortgage rates would all then be set on top of those rates. And there would be little tendency for boom and bust under both conditions. Okay. Question, exactly. As far as I know, the explanation of mainstream economics for the recent bust is very similar to what you are saying. Well, everybody tells the same history of the events. And so in the telling of events, we shouldn't expect to see much deviation. It's a matter of the explanation of events, and that's something that I definitely hope to get to in this class. I want to take specifically the Keynesian theory and the real business cycle theory and the Austrian theory and basically integrate what they have to say in terms of discussing this business cycle within the Austrian framework, because what they come up with are just merely features that are already incorporated into the Austrian theory of the business cycle. And it's only the Austrian theory of the business cycle that actually tells us what the cause of this crisis was. Well, I think we're a little bit over time, so I will call it a day here. I'll certainly read the remaining questions, maybe have them sent to me and make sure that I get to the remaining questions. So thanks for being here, and we'll see you next week.